Hello, and welcome to The Secret Sits. Today, I want to start with a question. Who are you? Why do we have secrets? What would happen if we just showed the world our actual selves? Many of us have so much social media that the lines between reality and social media really sometimes get blurred. Sometimes this is on purpose, possibly because we don't feel like giving 100% of ourselves out to the universe. Or possibly there's a fear of accepting our own flaws and allowing everyone around us to see the flaws for what they are, the parts of us that make us unique and interesting. But somehow, those parts still embarrass us. There's a reason we as a communal society have social media and put ourselves on it. And those reasons are different for everyone. In today's episode, social media is going to play a part, a very large part, in the things that happen to a family who maybe wanted to use social media for a joyful and honorable reason. Or maybe it was a more sinister reason and more of a secret than anyone realized before it was too late. Today we are going to discuss the story of Jennifer and Sarah Hart and how a notable and poignant social media circus contributed to a tragic family annihilation. Sarah and Jennifer Hart were both originally from South Dakota, and both women attended Northern State University in Aberdeen, South Dakota. Both women decided to major in elementary education, with Jennifer focusing on special education. This is where Jen and Sarah's romantic relationship started. The women stayed closeted at first. However, they eventually decided that their relationship was important enough to them to come out of the closet. Now, 2004 South Dakota was not one of the most gay-friendly places to come out of the closet. Now, when I chose to come out of the closet, it was 1997 in rural Alabama. So I know the feeling of ostracism that these ladies were dealing with. This socially exclusive behavior by their fellow South Dakotans prompted the couple to move to Alexandria, Minnesota in 2004. And things seemed to be going pretty well for Jen and Sarah after the move, and the couple decided to look into foster care and adoption. The couple fostered their first child in 2004. In previous interviews, this foster child has asked to remain anonymous, so we're going to continue to honor her wishes here today. This foster child was 15 years old when she came to live with Jen and Sarah, and there was conflict between the three women almost from the start. You see, Jen and Sarah wanted to impose their ideas and parenting onto this foster child, but possibly they couldn't allow themselves to take a step back and look at the situation from the outside and make some, adjustments. You see, this foster child was also a tomboy and didn't like or want any of the girly things that Jen and Sarah were providing. At one point, Jen and Sarah took her to get one of those makeup counter makeovers where you sit in a chair at a makeup counter in one of those big anchor stores at the mall, and everyone walks by as a girl in a strange white lab coat, cakes makeup on someone's face, and soon they look like a 30-year-old woman rather than a 15-year-old girl. Well, of course this is not what she wanted, and accordingly so. She sat sulking through the makeover process, her head drooped and retreating into herself, as all of us did when we were insecure teenagers, doing something that was being thrust upon us by our well-meaning yet naive parents. It's now 2005, and same-sex marriage has become a huge topic of conversation all around the world. It was not legal in the United States of America at this point, however, Sarah goes to court and asks the court to legally change her last name to match that of her domestic partner, Jen. The court allowed Sarah to change her name, and I'm sure Jen and Sarah now feel as close to married as they'll be able to get for quite a while. I remember in 2005, my now husband and I had been together for just a few years. However, That feeling you have inside when you're wondering if you'll ever have the same rights as everyone around you? I mean, those feelings are almost insurmountable in your heart, and it's a lot of weight to bear. So I'm sure that this name change lifted Sarah and Jen's hearts and elevated how at least they saw their relationship. The couple had now applied to adopt children. Maybe in their minds, this is what they truly wanted, not a foster child, but a child that would belong to them. A child that isn't going to be taken away whenever the foster care system decided to do so. And fostering children is an awesome thing. Giving a warm and loving home to a child in need is such a selfless act, but not everyone can handle it. For some, falling in love with a child while they're in your care, just to have to watch them leave after being adopted by another family, is just more than they can bear. But isn't it their right to feel that way? On March 4th, 2006, Jen and Sarah received a call from Colorado County, Texas, that they had a set of 3 siblings for Jen and Sarah to adopt. They were so excited. They were going to get their own kids, and they involved their foster daughter in the excitement. They told her that she was going to be a big sister to these new kids, and I would imagine she was very excited. To go from being an only child in a house to being a big sister of 3 new kids would at the very least bring some level of excitement into your life. Now we are 1 week to the day that Jen and Sarah's new kids are arriving from Texas. Their foster daughter has an appointment with her therapist, and during the course of her therapy appointment, her therapist tells her that the Harts felt she was no longer a good fit for their family, and that they would not be picking her back up from this appointment, and that she would be moved into a new home. She never saw Jen and Sarah Hart again, and she remembers just being devastated. Jen and Sarah's 3 children were Abigail, who went by Abby, she was 2, Hannah, age 4, and Marcus, age 7. Their biological parents had had their parental rights terminated by a court in Harris County, Texas, in August, and the children were formally adopted by Jen and Sarah that September. Abby wore glasses and had a bright smile. She loved the color lime green, and she loved exploring in the wilderness. Hannah had a spunky personality. She had high-set apple cheeks and was missing both of her front teeth. Marcus, the oldest, loved to read. He loved to read so much that he read the entire Twilight Vampire book in one night. 1 year for Christmas, Marcus asked for a world with no cancer. Starting in 2006, Jen became a stay-at-home mom, while Sarah worked as a supervisor at a hamburger shop. Sarah was described by friends and coworkers as being very confident, assertive, and she could also sometimes be intimidating. Jen was described as a bit warmer and more relatable. These 3 children brought very little drama in their first 2 years with Jen and Sarah. And in June of 2008, Jen and Sarah adopted 3 additional children. Now, Jen and Sarah had asked for something very specific during the adoption process. They asked specifically for black children that were sets of siblings. And that is exactly what they got. 3 more children who were all black and also siblings. This adoption brought Devante, age 6, Jeremiah, age 4, and Sierra, age 3. These 3 came to the Hart House from Houston, Texas. These 3 new children came from a bit of a rough start in life. Their biological mother lost her custody because, like so many other Americans, she was struggling with substance abuse problems. And at least one of the children had tested positive for cocaine at the time of their birth. Now, I'm no adoption expert, nor have I ever had to deal with Child Protective Services, or CPS, during my lifetime. But there are a few things I wanted to cover in this situation. The children's familial aunt took the children with a condition that their mother was not allowed to have any contact with the children. And I believe that this is a natural first placement through CPS. If there is a family member who is willing and capable to take in the children so that they can have the smallest disruption possible, well, then that's a good thing. However, in this case, their aunt, just like all of us, had some struggles. Her struggles included money, and hey, who doesn't struggle with money at least sometimes or all the time? So after just having taken in three new children, her place of work called her and asked if she could come in and cover an extra shift. And she thought, well, I need the money. So, needing the extra money, but unable to find a babysitter at the last moment, she called her sister, the baby's biological mother, to come and babysit while she ran in and pull the extra shift at work. Things may have gone swimmingly, but this day also just happened to be the day that CPS had a caseworker do an unannounced surprise visit to the house and check on the children. And when the caseworker showed up to find the children being supervised by the one person who was not allowed to contact them, the caseworker pulled the children from the house. Now, the aunt attempted to obtain permanent custody of the children, but because of this specific incident, the courts would not allow it. Sometimes the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I think we have all done something like this at some point in our lives. Our intentions in our minds are so good, but one incident can mar those intentions, and maybe what we thought would make a situation better just boggles it all up. But that's okay, because we can move forward and grow from it and become better for it. So at this point, Jen and Sarah are making most of their income off of the adoption stipend that they're allotted by the state of Texas while still living in Minnesota. The three new children brought so much life into the Hart house. Sierra was the smallest and now the baby of the family. She loved her cat that she called Sebastian. Jeremiah was small for his age. He was born with cocaine already in his system, but he was doing okay, and everyone called him J-Man. And Devante. I think Devante was an old soul in a child's body. Devante loved animals and hated Donald Trump. He carried a sign with him reading, "Free hugs, pass it on." And he had a special bond with Jen, which would sometimes garner him some special attention. Now, Jen was a stay-at-home mom, and possibly because of this, she became almost obsessed with social media. Jen's social media of choice was mostly Facebook. Jen was extremely active on social media, and she loved to post pictures of the children doing everyday activities with well-written and thought-out captions, each post showing a loving, wholesome family. But just like we discussed earlier, social media is a tool. A tool that you can use to manipulate, to make it look like you have whatever kind of life you would like to portray. And I will say this, I know there are people that are completely open about their lives, and you see their good and their bad days on their social media. But there are those that only like to post about good things. And looking at their social media, you might think, what are they hiding? Or, no one's life is all good. Well, you would be right. No one's life is all good. But some people only feel comfortable sharing the good. And there is nothing wrong with that. Look, misery loves company. But for some, sharing hardships in your life is just too big of a window into their soul, and they're not comfortable sharing everything with everyone in the world. The Harts found their comfortable place in the world when they started attending transformational festivals. These festivals were full of music and dancing, yoga and mindfulness. The people who attended these festivals were and are all about inclusion and acceptance. This seemed to be exactly what a pair of lesbian mothers with six black children needed. Jen would often post photos from these festivals with all the children wearing huge smiles, and will post inspiring updates from their daily life. One friend said that she was a master poster. Commenters would leave glowing remarks about their parenting. Some even asked if they would ever consider doing their own reality TV show. They would come to be known as the Heart Tribe at these festivals, and there was something magnetic about this family. They drew the attention of everyone around them, and they were easily recognized by everyone who attended these festivals. Jen was also obsessed with one of those online games called Oz Broken Kingdom, where you have to build a community of other players, spend actual money to progress along in the game. One online friend from this gaming community said that Jen was one of the highest ranking players, which would have cost a lot of money and almost all of her free time. So as she is supposedly raising these children, she is at home playing an online video game for almost 12 to 14 hours a day and putting their family into almost $16,000 in debt. In 2008, while the family was living in Minnesota, Hannah Hart was seen with bruises on her left arm. And when a teacher asked Hannah about the bruise, she said she'd been hit by Jen with a belt. The school contacted Jen and Sarah about the allegation, and within months, all six children had been pulled out of public school for the rest of the year. Jen decided she would homeschool the children. For some reason, the children were sent back to public school in 2009. However, in 2010, Abby told a school nurse that she had owies on her back and stomach. Now, I know that when I was a kid, I had bruises and cuts and scrapes all of the time. For a while, I had to go get stitches at the ER so many times that the doctor knew me by name. I just want to add this because we can be an overly protective and extremely litigious society. Not that being overprotective of children is wrong, but sometimes kids get hurt on their own, just playing, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, sometimes adults are doing the wrong thing, and they're causing childhood injuries, which is wrong and criminal. That happened to be Abby's claim about these owies. Abby told a story that she had found a penny, and when it fell out of her pocket in front of Jen, Jen had accused her of stealing the penny. I mean, from God knows where, and it's a penny. But Abby told Jen she had found the penny, and according to Abby, Jen held Abby's head underwater and hit her. Sarah told police that she had been the one to spank Abby, and Jen backed up her account. Now, this is a point we have to question in good faith. Jen, by all accounts from all the children, was the one issuing the physical discipline in the house. So why did the couple say it was Sarah? Did they have a fear that Jen would no longer be able to homeschool the children? Why would they purposely switch who had been the disciplinarian when they spoke with officials? When the authorities got involved, all children claimed they had been spanked constantly and deprived of food. In 2010, Sarah is charged with malicious punishment of a child and misdemeanor domestic assault, according to Minnesota court records. 1 year later, Hannah reportedly told a school nurse that she had not eaten all day. The school nurse called Hannah's home and spoke to Sarah, who claimed that Hannah was merely playing the food card and recommended that Hannah just be given water. Around this time, all six children were taken out of public schools, and they would be homeschooled from then on. This most likely prompted the Hart family's next move, this time to Oregon. During the family's time in Oregon is when the misdeeds of this family finally starts its trajectory toward a sad and cruel fate. As we know, Jen keeps an almost obsessive social media feed around the family. Pictures of the family at festivals, rallies, and around the house working on art projects or playing music. One clip of the family shows the kids singing, and the only words to the song seem to be, "We are so provided for." A constant life of illusions lived on social media that may have been hiding a much more sinister home life for these six children. Following their move to Oregon in 2013, a few people called into CPS to report some troubling things they had noticed. According to one CPS report, an anonymous person who had called the children trained robots brought attention to the alleged facade of Jen's Facebook posts. Jen does this thing for her Facebook page where the kids pose and are made to look like one big happy family, but after the photo event, they go back to looking lifeless. The person also said they seemed scared to death of Jen. A former friend of theirs also called Child Protective Services after the Hart family had stayed with them, claiming Jen handled the children like a regimented boot camp, adding that she would often get angry if they laughed too loudly. Now, CPS began an investigation into the Hart children's welfare. This investigation included separate interviews of everyone in the family, as well as interviews of people who knew the family. Two family friends said that the children were forced to raise their hands before speaking, could not wish each other a happy birthday, and could not laugh at the dinner table. There were other reports that the children were poorly fed and looked small for their ages. One family friend reported that Jen had ordered a pizza for the children, but each was only allowed to have one small slice. Now the next morning, when Jen discovered that the rest of the pizza was gone, she punished all the children by not feeding them breakfast and forcing them to lie flat on their beds for 5 straight hours. However, the interviews of the children themselves revealed no new incidents of abuse, nor did they mention anything that had happened in Minnesota. When Jen herself was interviewed, she claimed that any family problems were the result of others not being tolerant toward two lesbian mothers with 6 black children. In the end, the investigation could not conclude whether the Harts were guilty of anything or whether there was any safety threat in the home. While attending the beloved festival, Devante is dressed in a zebra onesie with the word "beloved" shaved into his hairline. On a now famous YouTube video, you can see Devante at this festival as the musician Xavier Rudd plays a guitar and chants on stage. Xavier notices Devante in his zebra costume and a sign around his neck reading "free hugs." Devante slowly approaches Xavier with tears in his eyes, and then they embrace. This embrace lasts over a minute, and you can see everyone in the crowd getting swept up in the moment. But as you watch this scene unfold, you might start to notice that something doesn't seem quite right. It's almost like Devante wouldn't let go, and maybe he needed to receive this hug more than he needed to give it. Devante Hart was 12 years old when he was thrust into the national spotlight. You may remember a photo of Devante that went viral after the 2014 protest in Portland resulting from the Ferguson unrest. Now, I know that there were a lot of protests in 2020, and for great reasons. Just as a reminder, the Ferguson unrest was because of the senseless killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson, who no charges were filed against. Now, the Hart family is at the protest. Devante is dressed in a brown leather jacket with a blue shirt with an orange crew neck collar and a fedora hat. And he has his "free hug" sign as always. In the photo, Devante is seen hugging a white police officer in riot gear with tears streaming down Devante's face, which we'll post on our social media. This image became known as the hug felt round the world. Because of the notoriety of the hug felt round the world photo, the Hart family is suddenly getting a lot of attention. The photo and the story behind it had gone out over all of the mainstream media channels and had even been parodied on Saturday Night Live that week. The family was contacted by the Bernie Sanders campaign team, and they were invited to be on the bleachers directly behind Bernie at his campaign speech in Portland, Oregon in 2016. Now, to cue your memory, the Hart family is standing in the bleachers behind then-presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders when a bird lands on his lectern during his speech. They were the exact right optics to be in the background of a very liberal political candidate. After all of the attention the family was receiving, Jen decided that the family needed a break from social media. By mid-2017, after their social media break, Jen revealed the family had moved to Woodland, Washington. This is their third state since adopting their children. And while they tried to remain private, their neighbors eventually reported an incident to the police. In August of that year, Hannah Hart jumped out of her bedroom window, her second story bedroom window, at around 1:30 a.m. to try to contact her next door neighbors, who she had never even met. She jumped out of her window and ran across the dark yard to the DeKalb's house. She started pounding on the door, and as soon as it opened, she just bolted into their house and ran straight up their stairs to hide, pleading with them, "Don't make me go back. They're racists and they abuse us." Bruce DeKalb asked Hannah to explain, and she said that they whipped them with belts, which at first didn't seem too out of place for Bruce, who admitted to Hannah that he too had been hit with a belt as a child. I mean, raise your hand if you were hit with a belt growing up. I could raise both my hands. The couple did not know Hannah and had never met any of the Hart children. They could soon hear the Hart family outside in the yard with flashlights looking for Hannah. Sarah and Jen then came to the DeKalb house and knocked on the door. When Bruce and Dana opened the door, the Harts just pushed their way into the DeKalb house with no invitation. They started searching the DeKalb house for Hannah, and they eventually found her upstairs, curled up in the fetal position. Dana DeKalb didn't call authorities at this time, but she did tell her father, Steve, who did call the police, and told them about the night Hannah had ran to their house.
There's some kids that I feel is being highly abused.
What's the address?
And how I know... Okay, I'm going to give you the address of my daughter's house because it's right next door. Yeah, if you're going up the road to her house, it's the house on the right.
Okay, and what's going on there?
Well, they have black children, which that part doesn't matter, and they're new here. But the other night, a little girl jumped out of the second story window on the roof and then down onto the ground and ran to my daughter, and this is like 2 a.m, begging them to help her. And when they came looking for her, she was begging my daughter not to let him know she was there. And then eventually my son-in-law let him know. He doesn't want to get involved, but the more I sit on it, I just can't live with it. Somebody's got to go there and check on
And so how old was the little kid that did that, that ran to your daughter's house?
About 12 years old, 13. And then she had all four of the kids come back later and to say everything was okay, and they were all standing at attention like they were just scared to death. And I think there's something very serious going on there. They're here from Texas. The kids might even be kidnapped. And basically, my son-in-law is like most people. They don't want to get involved. And so he's keeping my daughter out of it. But since she's told me about it, I just can't live with it. I'm very concerned for these kids.
Jen later attempted to explain this by saying that Hannah was lying. that the children occasionally acted out because they were drug babies, and that Hannah's biological mother was bipolar. But considering that Hannah at this time was 15 years old and had been with Jen and Sarah for 11 years, I would think that excuse would not hold much water. After this incident, the DeKalbs were also in contact with Devante, who was constantly begging them for food and asking the DeKalbs not to tell Jen about these requests. This started as once per day, but quickly escalated to Devante showing up at their house up to 3 times per day. They eventually put a box out in the yard between the two houses, so Devante could pick up food from it with less chance of getting caught by his mothers. In later conversations with Devante, he told them that his mothers withheld food as punishment and that the children were sometimes abused. This, combined with the earlier incident with Hannah, made the DeKalbs report the Harts to Child Protective Services. CPS workers tried to reach the Harts twice, with no success. It appeared that the family had picked up all 6 kids and the family dog, and they had just vanished. In the final days, the family members left their home in Woodland, California, and headed south. Now, little is known of their seemingly hasty departure or the days that would follow, but the details speak of a possibly disturbing demise for the poor children. In their final days, the family members left their home in Woodland, California, and headed south. Little is known of their seemingly hasty departure or the days that followed, but the details speak of a possibly disturbing demise for these children. On March 26th, one of Sarah's friends called 911 requesting a welfare check. The friend stated that she had received a text from Sarah saying that she was sick, and her phone was now dead, and no one had seen her or her wife. What happened to the family is not completely clear, but at some point on the 24th, the day after CPS was contacted by the DeKalbs, the Hart family made it to Mendocino County, California. On the morning of March 25th, Jen Hart is recorded on surveillance video at a Safeway in Fort Bragg, about 15 miles south of where the family was found dead the next day. They remained in the area until at least 9 p.m., but there's no further information regarding the family's whereabouts until their SUV was found upside down on the Pacific Coast. The vehicle appears to have left a highway for a dirt turnout, then accelerated on that turnout for about 70 feet until it sailed off the cliff, Thelma and Louise style. No skid marks were found, and this led the investigators to determine that Jen had intentionally driven her entire family off of the cliff. After some investigation and time, here's what we now know. Before this accident, Sarah was Googling questions such as, can 500 milliliters of Benadryl kill a 120-pound woman? What over-the-counter medications can you take to overdose? How can I easily OD on over-the-counter medications? Is death by drowning relatively painless? How long does it take to die of hypothermia in water while drowning in a car? Lastly, Sarah searched for no-kill dog shelters. At the time of her death, Sarah had taken 42 doses of an off-brand Benadryl. The family had stopped to buy the medicine before even leaving Washington, and they had purchased both pills and liquid forms of the drug. At the time of their autopsies, Marcus had 19 doses of Benadryl in his system. Abby had 14, and Jeremiah had 9. Jen, who was driving, did not have the drug in her system, but had a blood alcohol level of 0.10, or about 5 beers. Now, Jen was not a drinker, so she was probably intoxicated quickly and she was probably almost non-functioning. Sarah was Googling so many things, it stands to reason that they had no formal plan on what their intentions were going to be. The day before their accident, when Sarah bought those groceries at Safeway, she bought 8 toothbrushes and deodorant at a nearby Dollar Tree, and these just don't seem to be items you would purchase hours before planning on taking your own life. However, on Saturday night, Jen and Sarah Hart switched off their SUV's GPS system for the first time in 8 years. Jen and Sarah Hart murdered all 6 of their children when Jen Hart drove their SUV over a 100-foot cliff on California State Route 1 in Mendocino County, California, near Westport. The bodies of the 5 children, Hannah 16, Marcus 19, Jeremiah 14, Abby 14, and Sierra 12, were found in or nearby the vehicle, which landed upside down on a Pacific Ocean beach. The body of Devontae Hart, 15 years old, has still never been found. A Superior Court judge ruled that Devontae was in the vehicle at the time of the crash, and a death certificate was signed for him on April 3, 2019. When police searched their home, investigators described it as sterile, with empty picture frames hung on the wall, and the kids' rooms had 2 small beds and a mattress on the floor, but not much else. One officer wrote in his report, "I did not get any indication that children lived in this house." While the women had been together for over 18 years after meeting at Northern State University, and Jen often posting loving tributes to Sarah on social media, records released by the Clark County Sheriff's Office in November revealed marital issues. In 2010, Jen described their home life as very roller coaster-ish in an email she had sent. She explained to a friend that, "For quite some time, I have felt very underappreciated and taken for granted in our relationships, and at times, unloved. While I know deeply in my heart how much she loves me, she is just horrible about showing it." In a Facebook post in 2016, Jen wrote, "We've come to realize that some think our lives are next to perfect. We are human, and we struggle through life's obstacle course just like everyone else." Later on, she looked back on the first half of 2017, claiming, "This year slammed us hard." So here we are, left with a family full of secrets that they took to their untimely and watery grave. The secrets of Sarah and Jen and their true motives, their true intentions for having these precious children. And the secrets of Devontae's childhood innocence and the walls that crumbled in the public eye, letting us glimpse into his beautifully tragic soul. What secrets do you think this case is hiding? And how can we help to make sure a tragedy like this doesn't happen so easily again? Make sure that you subscribe to The Secret Sits wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcast so we can expand our audience and continue bringing you quality episodes each week.